Good morning. Please turn with me in your Bibles to the book of 1 Timothy chapter 3. And while you're doing so, let me thank Andy for accomplishing several of my tasks. He got in the Gators. And he talked about Ashley. So half of my work is done here. 1 Timothy chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. This is a faithful saying. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, able to teach, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous. One who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Not a novice, lest being puffed up with pride he fall into the same condemnation as the devil. Moreover, he must have a good testimony among those who are outside, lest he fall into reproach and the snare of the devil. I want to thank Mike and the board for the opportunity to speak at this year's lectures. I feel sort of like Brother Joseph Casimir did a few years ago at the Florida College lectures when he was asked to be one of the evening speakers. He said when he got the invitation, his response was, "Why me?" And I feel much the same way. Why me? I came to these lectures last year with a bit of apprehension. I had been a few years before and was somewhat disappointed. I felt out of place. And when I came last year, I came to see my daughter, who is going to Western, and I talked with Mike after the lectures and told him how much I enjoyed the lectures and I was impressed with the speakers and the subject. And I thoroughly enjoyed being here for that. And Mike and I talked for a while and have continued to communicate. And he invited me to speak. And I'm thankful for that opportunity. And I'm happy that my good wife is here with me this week. She is the reason that I am able to preach the gospel. I tell people that she works to support my preaching habit. And that is true. Happy to have our other child with us, our son Wayne, our oldest. He's with us here from Florida. Now, the task that I've been assigned for these lectures is to talk about the non-family qualifications of elders, or the other qualifications. And I would recommend that you take your lecture book and put it away. I'm not going to follow the book other than to talk about those 19 qualifications that are the other family qualifications. And you might, when you get home, you might want to take my part of the lecture book and tear it out and use it to line some animal's cage or level an uneven table at home. That's probably about the worth of it. But I want you to study with me from the text this morning. We're going to look at those qualifications that are listed both in 1 Timothy and in Titus. God saw fit that men, qualified men, should shepherd the flock of God among them from Acts chapter 20 and verse 7. And he gave us a pattern for a scripturally organized church. In Philippians chapter 1 and verse 1, Paul and Timothy, a bondservant of Jesus Christ, to all the saints in Christ Jesus who were in Philippi, with the bishops and deacons. I serve as an evangelist for a congregation of God's people in my hometown in Lakeland, Florida. That is where I grew up, and it's the congregation where my wife and I were attending when we got married and our first child was born. And as I said in the lecture book, until recently I have labored with congregations without elders, but for the past 2 years I have worked with shepherds. But a few months ago I began to notice that these men were getting old. Two of these men were elders when I was very young in attending that congregation, and one of them keeps telling me, "You're going to be saying words over me soon." One of our elders just had a pacemaker installed. His wife suffered a stroke. Another one just looks feeble. Our youngest elder is a school principal and he's about to retire. He and his wife just built a retirement home in North Georgia. We know that he won't be with us very long. And I very quickly realized that we could be without elders very quickly. And so I had a conversation with the elders in my regular meeting with them, and we talked about new elders. And then I had lunch with one of the men who we all thought should be one to be considered. And other than him, we sadly don't see a lot of prospects unless it's further down the road. But this man just simply told me, "Bobby, I just don't have the desire." He said, I know that I need to change my attitude about that. He said, I know that if we need elders, that I should have a different attitude. He basically declined. And if they get really desperate, maybe they could use me. Why is this so? That question has been raised a lot of times in these lectures. And I don't have a definitive answer. I'm sorry if you were looking for those answers. I don't have them either. I'm searching for them as well. But the point is this, brethren, that this cannot wait. We see some men down the road, but who they will be ready, but who knows how long, and the immediate future doesn't look very good for new elders. In a congregation the size that I preach for, that ought not to be. We range from 150 to 180 to maybe over 200 at some times. Why is it that so many congregations don't have elders? I've contemplated this question, and again, I don't have the clear answer. But the theme of this lectureship is a crisis in leadership, and I believe one of the biggest crises is that too many congregations don't have qualified men to lead. What are we going to do? Brethren, we better get busy training young men and instilling in them the desire to serve as elders when they reach maturity, and if not to be elders, then to be deacons. And I don't mean teenagers. I mean younger than that need to be trained for this job. The text tells us in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and in Titus 1 that an elder must be a man. Now, how many of us have joked about the elderess or the deaconess in our congregations? While we realize that many women serve a very important part in the work of the kingdom, we must be careful that we don't become like the nations around us, as Brother Tom just talked to us about. The denominations are appointing women to roles that are clearly commanded to be filled by a man. The Greek phrase here is aetes. Vine says that it is rendered a man. Not only must his gender be a man, but he needs to be a man in every sense of the word. Far too often, men serving as shepherds do not lead. They need to be men who are men and not be afraid of leading the flock. They need to have a backbone. They need to grow a spine. They should not be afraid of leading the flock in difficult situations. An attitude that says we don't want to cause trouble or offend members is not the kind of leadership needed amongst God's people. We need men to fill these roles. The second qualification is that he must desire the office. Thayer says that that means to stretch oneself out in order to touch or grasp something, to reach after or desire something. And Vine says it's only used in the middle voice, signifying the mental effort of stretching oneself out for a thing or longing after it, with stress upon the object desired. I made reference to the conversation that I had with the one man who quite simply does not desire the office of the bishop. And again, I asked the question, why is that? And I think in that case, that man has been burned out while serving as a deacon at another congregation, and therefore he has no desire to step into the role of an elder for fear of what will happen to him, what will come his way or to his family. How many men serving as elders have experienced this and therefore have no desire to serve in this capacity in the Lord's church? In my manuscript, I did talk about the attitude toward the office of an elder. And an attitude is simply our relationship one to another. I grew up in Florida and watched most of the Apollo and many of the shuttles go off from my home in Lakeland. And as we would watch the TV coverage later, they would talk about the spacecraft's attitude toward the Earth or its atmosphere. And if the attitude was wrong, the spaceship would either burn up on reentry or bounce off of the atmosphere and just be lost in space. What is our attitude toward the office of the bishop, toward the office of a shepherd? Do we desire it? What has happened that may prevent men from desiring it? And how many of you who are serving as shepherds can relate to this job at times as being a sounding board for the complaints of the congregation? Why did you guys do that? What in the world were you guys thinking when you did that? Does that sound familiar? As an evangelist, I screen a lot of those complaints for our elders because people naturally come and talk to me because we've done a great job of instilling the pastor system in our churches, haven't we? And 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse or 5 and verse 17 comes to mind that says, "Let the elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor." Elders are not to be treated that way. And maybe that's why some of them don't desire the office. The third qualification is that he must be blameless. I've never met a perfect man. I've read about one in the Scriptures. And when God gave these requirements for elders, He didn't intend that we should seek perfect men. One of our dry cleaners in town has a sign that says, "The more perfect a man is, the more women try to alter him, to take him to the altar and then alter him." Yet sometimes I think that we are looking for perfect men. There is no such thing. It's been talked about that we add to what God has said. We set the standard higher than what God has. What God intended for these men is born out of the definition given to us by Thayer of the word there. He said there is nothing that can be called into account. There is nothing on the balance sheet that is owed by this man. He is irreproachable. The same is required of all Christians, that we are to become blameless, Philippians 2 and verse 15. Elders are just men. They are going to make mistakes. The key is, for all of this, is what do we do about it? That's the key for all of us when we make mistakes. What do we do about it? How do we handle the mistakes that we've made? When we sin, we must repent. Now, it is understood that if an elder's character is severely flawed by sin, or if his conduct has brought reproach on the Lord's church, that cannot be tolerated. He must not serve in this office with such on his account. The next qualification is that he be temperate. And again, this is found in both of the texts. It is sometimes translated vigilant or not self-willed, not quick-tempered or self-controlled. Those words are used in Titus. And Thayer again tells us that this word can mean sober, temperate, abstaining from wine entirely, either entirely or at least from its immoderate sense. Part of the meaning found here is abstaining from wine, although that's dealt with in another word. But let me make it perfectly clear at this point that I do not endorse social drinking. When we consider the definitions given to us by Webster for the word temperate, for example, it means moderate in the indulgence of the appetites. All of us have been temperate this week in our eating, haven't we? It's lecture week. But it also means to be moderate in one's actions, in one's speech, and it is characterized by moderation, which includes moderation in the use of alcohol. The word vigilant is used in the passage in Titus. It means watchful, characterized by vigilance, especially alert to danger. That's part of the meaning of being temperate. And it's also translated as sober, which means temperate in the use of alcoholic liquor. As we've already noted, this requirement encompasses some of the requirements found in Titus. And so let's look briefly at some of those things, and we'll touch on those in Titus. First of all, Titus includes in the list that he's not to be self-willed. A man who is going to be a bishop in the Lord's church cannot place his own interest above that of the congregation. This is all part of being temperate. In matters of doctrine, there is no room for compromise. But in matters of opinion, he may have to put his feelings aside. And thus the bishop takes into consideration the sheep in his flock. Titus also says he's not to be quick-tempered. You know, sheep are going to do things that will cause elders to need a lot of patience. A man who is prone to anger or quick-tempered may not be temperate in his speech or his actions toward the member who causes him this grief. He must not be quick-tempered. Titus also says he must have self-control. And here we see a picture of a man who does not give in to his passions, his own self-will, or his anger. These are all part of being temperate. Now, the next one that we have listed in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and in verse 2 is that he must be sober-minded. And the word sophron here is defined by vine, means to be of sound mind. And hence, it means to be self-controlled and sober-minded. Now, here is more than just involved the idea of being free from the use of alcohol. As mentioned earlier, I do not endorse this. But the elder must have a good mind and be faithful in executing his duties. Sadly, many men do not possess this kind of mind, or they lose it with age. And this is something that the young man is not going to have. That's why he is an elder. He is an older man. And so we see God's wisdom in choosing older men. When we arrived in Bowling Green the other night, we had to make the traditional Walmart run. And we saw some elders. These are the young men with the white shirts, and they wear more colorful ties now. But these 18 and 19-year-old boys do not possess the mind needed for this office. God intended that these men be sober-minded. He also says, Paul also says in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 2, that they must have good behavior. And the idea here is a well-ordered life. Not a life of chaos, but one that is well-ordered. The bishop's life must be one that is an example in his spiritual life and in his life that intersects with the world. Whether it's people in the workplace or whatever area in the world he meets other people, he must show good behavior. He must have a well-ordered life. And the elder's life must be one that is an example in matters of speech. It must be good. His dress must be an example. It must not be immodest or that which draws attention to himself. He must have good behavior. The next one from Titus chapter 1 and verse 8 is that he must be a lover of what is good. Now the opposite of this idea is found in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and in verse 3, where Paul speaks of men as being despisers of good. In this case, the man must be the lover of what is good. These men must love good things. And actually the idea that is carried forth here is the idea of loving good people. We all have to deal with worldly people because we are in the world but not of the world. But what kind of people do we choose to associate with? When given a choice, we should choose good people. How many times do we get drawn away to those who are not the good people? This qualification seems to lend itself to the idea that elders should also be seeking out good younger men in the church and nurturing them, helping them to prepare for the future when they serve as elders. And so elders must be an example in staying away from that which is unfit for Christians, such as coarse talking, crude humor, innuendo, and if their friends are behaving like that, they need to stay away from it. Because they need to choose the good. Both Timothy and Titus list the next qualification, and that is he must be hospitable. And I want to thank everybody who's spoken before me. He's already covered that. But I'm still going to say something about it. We live in a time where hospitality has been taken largely out of the home, and in many cases, taken to the restaurant. Like me, I'm sure you're like me. You remember that Sunday afternoon you went to the family, some member of the family's house, and dinner was prepared. And you sat around the table and friends and church members would come and join you. And I'm not saying that you can't be hospitable in a restaurant. You can be. But does hospitality extend beyond the meal? I think it does, as has already been pointed out. Now, this requirement also extends to strangers as well as members of the flock. And again, I think our culture has affected us in this regard. I watched a young lady the other day as we were traveling up. She was pumping gas at the same station we were at. And a man who was obviously down and out was begging. He showed a veteran military ID, and she politely told him no. How many of us have convinced ourselves that we can't be hospitable, we can't help these people, because they'll just use it on booze, and we have to be a good steward of what God has entrusted to us? Isn't that right? Now, the sad thing about the story is that I had just told the man no also. I politely turned him down. I was not hospitable. Now, one of the questions that I raised in my manuscript about the elder who is a widow and his ability to be, is about the man who is a widow and his ability to be hospitable. I understand that he's already proven his character. And when his wife dies, though, when he is left as a widow, I think it's going to be very difficult. I think his ability to be hospitable, easy for me to say, is going to be diminished without a wife. But this is something that all of us are required to do. The next one is that he's to be apt to teach. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, and Titus verse 1, and chapter 1 and verse 9. Now, may I ask you, how does a man show that he is apt to teach? Doesn't he have to demonstrate that by actually teaching? Perhaps you're like me and you've heard people make the argument, well, he doesn't have to actually teach, he just has to be able to. Somebody's already used the line about being apt to teach. But sadly, some men who are serving as deacons, or as bishops rather, are no more knowledgeable than the average person in the pew. We used to be known as people of the book. We need to be again. And those who would serve as our shepherds, as our bishops, as our elders, need to be very knowledgeable in the Word of God. My conviction is that these men need to show the flock that they can teach by teaching publicly. And again, young men need to be taught to study to show themselves approved. And this is not something that can just be added at the last minute. It takes a lifetime of preparation to be apt to teach. Next is not given to wine. Can I say again, I do not endorse social drinking. The Christian has no business with alcohol. Period. I talked about our example, our influence in the text there. And I used Brother Philip's statement in my lecture that says, we are aware that the Bible does not literally forbid the drinking of any intoxicating drink, but the principles of Christianity do forbid it. And it would be a mistake for us to think that deacons might indulge a little in drinking, while elders are completely forbidden. What kind of example would that be? How will they obtain for themselves a good standing? 1 Timothy 3 and verse 13. Perhaps the strongest influence that a Christian can have is his example. If elders or Christians conduct themselves in a way that is not setting a good example, how will they answer in the judgment? The abuse of alcohol can certainly lead one to be a stumbling block to other Christians, not to mention leading to bad behavior or brawling, which is forbidden for elders. The next one is that he's not to be violent. 1 Timothy 3:3 and Titus 1:7. The Apostle Paul says that we are to live peaceably with all men in Romans 12 and verse 18. But we live in a world that is prone to violence. And we need to be very careful, and not just us average Christians, but elders as well. We need to be very careful with the things that we allow to influence us, because we are impacted by the world in which we live. And again, we are to be in the world, but not of the world. But everything from violent TV shows to video games or song lyrics or whatever it is, we must not allow ourselves to be influenced by the violence in our culture. And don't be mistaken in thinking that it's just the stuff that the kids watch. The stuff that we watch is full of violence and sex and innuendo and filthy talking. And we must not be allowed to be influenced by it. Men who possess the qualifications to be a shepherd in the Lord's church are going to be the ones who can control themselves from outbursts of wrath and anger. And when we see it modeled for us in society and in our entertainment, it is going to affect us. And we must not be ones who imitate that. We must not give in to those outbursts of wrath and anger. And this starts in the home with our interpersonal relationships with our family, and it carries into the workplace and into social settings and, of course, into the church. I said before that sometimes sheep are going to be very trying. They're going to test the patience of the shepherds. But the shepherd must not be violent in his reaction to them. Number 12 is not greedy for money. This is found not only in Timothy and Titus, but in 1 Peter chapter 5 and in verse 2. There's nothing wrong with having some money or some of this world's goods. This is not the emphasis of the requirement here, as I see it. The thrust of this qualification is talking about those who obsess over making money, those who are possessed with a desire to make money, who will spend most of their time, if not all of their time, trying to gain it. I've known of men, and I'm sure you have too, who have spent every possible moment working. If the opportunity for overtime arises, they take it. If they can take a second job, they take it. They don't have time to devote to their family, much less to the work of the Lord. And men who work in occupations that consume so much of their time will not have time to devote to the work of being a shepherd. And I think there are just some occupations that don't lend themselves to a man having enough time to be a shepherd. It takes time to be a shepherd. One cannot spend all of their free time making money and have any time left to be a shepherd. The shepherd must be gentle as well, or patient, as it's rendered sometimes. Paul admonishes gentleness for all Christians in Philippians 4 and verse 5, and that servants are to be gentle to all, 2 Timothy 2 and verse 24. And some versions use the word patience to translate the word. Now, Thayer says that it's from the word epi, which is unto, and akos, likely denotes seemly, fitting, equitable, fair, moderate, forbearing. It is rendered gentle in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 3, or patient. And it's in contrast to covetousness in Titus chapter 3 and in verse 2. It means gentle in association with meekness. So a man who fills the office of the elder must not be one who flies off the handle at one of the sheep or a fellow elder. Maybe this is where raising children comes into play. It's not good to yell and scream at your children. They don't listen. You might have their attention the first time, but soon they just learn to tune you out. But you can master the art of being authoritative in your speech to them without raising your voice. An elder must speak authoritatively without losing control. In 1 Peter 5, verses 2 and 3, Peter writes, "Shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, nor as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock." The elder must not be quarrelsome. That means not fighting. It has the idea of combat. Primarily, he says it signifies invincible, and it came to mean not contentious, not a brawler. This gives us the picture of a man who will not sink to the level of brawling to settle disputes. Can you imagine elders fighting? Coming to blows? It's hard to imagine, isn't it? But can you imagine elders being involved in extramarital affairs? It's hard to imagine, but it's happened. May we never hear of shepherds of the Lord's church engaging in such things. That's why we should make sure that these men don't have this tendency. The next one is that he's not to be covetous. Paul says that the bishop must not be greedy for money. In other words, he must be free from the love of money. And this is in keeping with the command that all disciples are to be without covetousness from Hebrews 13 and verse 5. And Paul says that no covetous man will have any inheritance in the kingdom. Ephesians 5 and verse 5. Elders are likely going to be in charge of dispersing the money collected on the first day of the week. Someone else may actually be the treasurer, but in a lot of cases they make the decisions. Whether we're talking about paying the preacher or supporting foreign work or maintaining the building or purchasing class materials and supplies, sadly some men who serve as elders are not willing to spend the Lord's money as it ought to be. Thankfully, preacher salaries are better. But sometimes the mentality is that we're going to hire the cheapest man so we can be a good steward of the Lord's money. But often you get what you pay for. Or they hire a man at a decent wage and then they don't give him a yearly increase. That means that the preacher goes further into the hole every year. I read the other day that the government doesn't think there was any cost of living increase last year. I think things cost me more. Somebody's already mentioned the countless men who are losing support or the ones in foreign fields that are losing support. What about the Bible class teacher that doesn't have adequate teaching material? Elders who are covetous with the Lord's money, who stockpile it against a rainy day, I wonder what answer they will give when the Lord returns and they are sitting on a big balance in the checkbook. I've talked with a number of men who do foreign work. And maybe I just don't know how to do it, to raise the money. But they've shared with me that they've had the same trouble in raising support to go and preach overseas. And I've been putting off a trip to South Africa for 2 years because I can't raise the support. And I know good and well that churches are sitting on money that they're not using it. But Lord willing, I'm going to go anyway, even if I have to pay for it. Because I spoke to a brother in South Africa the other day, and we've talked about a trip into Zimbabwe. He said, "Bobby, the people in Harare are clamoring for the gospel." I said, "Let's go." How will they answer the Lord when they sit on that big bank account as shepherds? He's not to be a novice. The idea here is that this is not someone who is newly planted, not a new convert. Now, people mature at different rates. And I marvel when I read through the book of Acts at the rapidity with which elders were appointed in those early churches. Some are going to be ready sooner than others, but it's not to be a new convert. As I mentioned a while ago, those young elders in Walmart that we saw the other night, these boys are not qualified in regards to biblical standards. They are novices in their faith. He must also have a good testimony from those outside. 1 Timothy 3 and verse 7. Why do you suppose that the Lord wanted this requirement here? Doesn't the shepherd work with the flock among them? Yes, he does. But how will he have a good influence on those without if he conducts shady business deals? How will he influence those outside if his conduct is unbecoming to a Christian? The men who hold this office must be shining examples not only to the flock, but to the world as well. Jesus said, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works." Matthew 5 and verse 16. The elders must also be just. This is the idea of righteous, observing divine and human laws. This is talking about one who is morally upright. You've seen the bumper sticker, "Morals matter, character counts." And that is especially true with those who would be shepherds in the Lord's church. Now, when it comes to doctrinal matters, there is no decision to be made because it must be what the Word of God says, period. But in other matters, he must render decisions that are fair, that are non-partial, that are upright, and that are equitable. One of the sad things that will happen is, if this is not followed, is that an unfair and inconsistent decision can be made. One party may be told one thing, and another party may be told something totally different if they are not just. And then the last one is that he must be holy, from Titus chapter 1 and verse 8. Peter says in 1 Peter 1 and verse 6, "Be holy, for I am holy." That's what God says. Arndt and Gingrich define the word as of talking about men as being devout, pious, pleasing to God, and holy. Now, this doesn't refer to one who has absolutely no sin. As we said before, none of us are perfect. But it means that this man is not dominated by sin. Sin does not rule his life. Sadly, there are cases where elders have been involved and preachers have been involved and other members of the church have been involved in gross sin. And we all sin. We all come short of the glory of God. But the idea here is that sin does not rule this man's life. Notice the larger context of what Peter said there in 1 Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 14. He says, "As obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lust, as in your ignorance. But as He who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Because it is written, 'Be holy, for I am holy.'" The picture painted of elders by the Apostle Paul in these two texts is complex. And yet I believe at the same time it is really rather simple. When we look at the list of qualifications and realize that the man who would occupy this office is one who will stand head and shoulders above the rest of the congregation. There are many things that go into meeting God's standards. That's quite a list. But as we've observed, maybe not in this lectureship, but we've observed in our studies that so many of these qualifications for elders are required of us as Christians as well. What we're talking about here is a man who is spiritually mature. Their spiritual maturity, their spirituality, their maturity in the faith should be evident to all people. It is really rather simple in the fact that these men begin by simply being what God calls us all to be. We all are to strive toward this. In the lecture book, under the section about desiring the office, I raised the idea of an elder shortage, and that has been talked about frequently here. And the suggested reason for this was stated as an attitude problem. What is our attitude, men, toward being an elder? Misunderstanding or lack of understanding of the office of bishop has probably contributed to this problem, because we've all seen those who are just the checkbook elders or who are the board of director type elders who are not shepherds. And our attitude may be that I don't want to be that. And maybe our attitude has been tainted because of the way we've seen elders treated. It is my belief that several generations of men have seen the problems faced by elders, beginning back with the division over institutionalism in the 50s and the 60s and continuing until the present time. And they want no part of being shepherds. Elders have had to deal with localized problems, a lack of respect from their congregations. I preached a sermon not too many weeks ago where I encouraged the people of our congregation to go to the elders when they had something good to say. And I think slowly they're getting the message. Make no mistake, battles have to be engaged. We have to stand for the truth. But the viciousness of that battle, no doubt, has soured some on being elders. Perhaps it's a lack of training of our young men that has contributed to this shortage. And as I said, we don't need to start with the teenagers. We need to start with the toddlers. Whatever the cause is, we must correct it so that in future generations, the Lord's church will not have this shortage of leaders. Young men must be counseled to prepare themselves. Young ladies need to be taught to be wives who will support their husbands in the work of this office. God's plan is for the church to be organized with the bishops and deacons. Let's get to work. More battles are going to come, and the Lord's church will no doubt be further divided. And the only hope of preserving a remnant is to have good, qualified men filling the office of elder as God intended. Thank you very much.